My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock. And I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, the thing is, I want to learn. And as it turns out, I work with people who know a lot about classical music. Every week on this show, one of my coworkers will give me a homework assignment, a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the Classical Classroom. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and today my instructor is going to be Ms. Catherine Liu, who is the host of Classical 91.7's afternoon concert and also the associate producer for The Front Row, our daily arts magazine. Catherine, welcome.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, it's
I don't have to do the interview for once.
Yeah. How does it feel to be on the receiving end?
Kind of cold. It's kind of cold in here.
That's why I wore my Snuggie. My really, really sexy Snuggie.
Houston Public Media.
Snuggie. Houston Public Media represent. So Catherine, as you may or may not know, is a violinist as well as a producer and host. So and as I was reading in your bio, I mean, I already knew you were a violinist, but I didn't know that you were actually a badass.
Why, thank you.
You're welcome.
Tell us a little bit about Texas All-State Orchestra. Okay. And yeah, those were good times. It was playing violin all while growing up, and orchestra was my main extracurricular activity in high school. And I did, you know, solo and ensemble contests, and was in the Texas All-State Orchestra.
Nice. Yeah, that's so cool. And it's funny because I was thinking about it, and so many of the announcers here at the station are also musicians, and somehow they're. Careers, their time spent doing music led them into classical radio. And
right.
So what was it that made you make that transition?
Well, I got my start in college radio.
Okay.
Back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, it was a student-run station in Chicago, and I had a... I haven't thought about this in a while. Thanks, Daisha. How old I am. I had my own show, and I did a minimalist show.
Really?
Yes.
No way.
So I got all the Philip Glass and Steve Reich out of my system. No, I still love the minimalist, but it was like wall-to-wall minimalism for me. Yes.
Was it like an hour-long show?
It was an hour-long show.
Okay.
It was simply called Minimalism. All lowercase.
Well, that's fitting, nice and minimalist.
But I was also an English major.
Oh, yeah.
As were you, Daisha Clay.
True story.
Which is part of the reason that I chose A Midsummer Night's Dream by Mendelssohn for us to talk about today. I know I will be getting into that. But yeah, I thought it would be really fun to have a literature connection in the piece. That we're doing. We can geek out on Shakespeare together. And also, of course, I love this piece of music. One of the first that I fell in love with.
It's really a great piece. And as I was listening to it, I realized that I've heard this piece over and over again here at the station, just, you know, in the overhead speakers. And I've always wondered, why the hell are they playing the Wedding March? Like, I didn't realize that it was the last movement of this. Is it called a symphony? I saw that it's called incidental music.
Yes. Okay. So this is considered incidental music, which means music written usually for another form of art.
Okay.
So... music written for the stage, for the theater in this case. You could say it's written for dance, or video games would be considered incidental music, and movie music is also considered incidental music. But so it could be background music. It's incidental to what's happening on screen or on stage, but sometimes it can be so good as it is in this case, where you can appreciate it on its own. It has its own sort of world of emotions and tells the story in its own way.
So is that then what you call this collection of how many movements is it?
The entire incidental music is, it has a lot of movements, even has vocal sections.
Oh, really?
So we're not going to talk about all of it today. What's most often performed and what you might most often hear on the radio is a suite of the instrumental sections.
Okay.
So that is what we have. You could call it a suite. The suite from the incidental music is what we're going to be talking about and listening to today.
So this is just a chunk of something much greater that Mendelssohn wrote. I see. You know, I was, speaking of the literature connection, I was going over, it's been a long time since I read that play, so I was refreshing my memory, reading some spark notes, which no one should do, students.
And I love this play. This is also my favorite Shakespeare play.
It's kind of like, it's called, you know, A Midsummer Night's Dream, but what it really reads as is A Midsummer Night's Acid Trip. It's so weird, kind of like the whole fairy scene in the woods with Puck, and they're putting some kind of potion onto people's eyes so that they'll fall in love. I mean, that just sounds like drugs.
But it's so fun. It's a good time.
It is. I mean, it's really, it's, you know, like a good Shakespeare comedy. It's great and it's surprising, you know, it's how contemporary some of it is.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. I also read some Cliff Notes to refresh my own memory. So, you know, this play is a comedy by Shakespeare, and it is set in a magical forest. And it moves between the fairy world and the human world. So in the fairy world, we have Oberon, the king of the fairies, and then Titania, the queen of the fairies. And they're having some issues because Titania has this changeling boy that Oberon wants. She won't give him up. So he plots to have Puck, his fairy servant, to cast a spell on Titania to fall in love with the first thing she sees, so that while she's in this kind of confused state, he can take the changeling boy from her.
Like this potion that they're using is some sort of love potion, and they wipe it over your eyelids, and when you wake up, you're the first person you see. You fall in love with, and this is the place from whence the hilarity ensues.
Yes, problems arise from this. This potion that's supposed to fix everything. So we've got that going on, and then in the human world, Theseus, who is the Duke of Athens, is getting married to Hippolyta. Okay, so, and this is like the event of the season. So this is like, you know, Kate and William getting married. Everybody's talking about it. And because of that, we have a group of what is often referred to as the Rude Mechanicals. So the Rude Mechanicals are basically like these lovable rednecks who want to, you know, get in on the action and the festivities. So they're getting ready to put on a play. And the main guy in the group of mechanicals is Bottom, who he wants to play all the leads in the production. Bottom is being a pain in the bottom, and he gets changed into, can I say ass?
You can totally say ass.
He's a pain in the ass. He gets changed into an ass by Puck. And then Puck arranges it so that when Titania, back to the fairy queen, when she's under her spell, when she wakes up, the first person she sees will be Bottom as a donkey, and she'll fall in love with him, and then shenanigans ensue. And then the last part, the part that you need to know about the play, is also crowding this magical forest are two other human couples. We have Hermia, who is in love with Lysander, but her father wants her to marry Demetrius. And Demetrius also loves Hermia. So there you've got your love triangle, but who loves Demetrius.
Helena. Yeah, who is Hermia's good friend. And so Hermia calls her up and she's like, girl, I'm getting married this weekend. Are you going to come? And so then they all go into the forest together, Helena hoping to, you know, snag Demetrius. But oh, that does not happen. Not at first.
And then Oberon, the fairy king, sees all of this and thinks this is really messed up. And he tells Puck, like, what's wrong with these foolish humans? They don't know anything about love. He wants Puck to, like, write the situation so everybody loves who they're supposed to. And Puck is supposed to use that potion that you described to get people to wake up and love the right person. But he keeps messing it up. And you could argue maybe on purpose, like for his own amusement. So he keeps messing it up. He can't get the combinations right. And this causes more hilarity in the forest. Then he finally gets it right, and he has them fall asleep, wake up in love with the right person, and believing that it was all a dream. And this all leads to the triple weddings and the wedding march at the end.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in why Mendelssohn wrote this music. Was he writing it for a performance of the play?
He was. Like okay. He was commissioned by, I think, the King of Prussia. Oh. To write this music for a production. And this would have been in 1842. But the interesting thing, and we can cue up the overture, the interesting thing about the overture is that the overture was written early. The overture was written in 1826, 16 years earlier, independently, when Mendelssohn was only 17.
Whoa.
Yeah, so at that time, he just loved the play, like you and me.
Right. Yeah.
He loved this play, and he was just inspired to write what's called a concert overture, an overture that stands alone, that is not for a stage production, just to be enjoyed as a piece, a single movement piece.
Okay.
In fact, a concert overture is the precursor to the symphonic poem, which you and Amy Bishop discussed
the tone
recently.
Poem.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's kind of the predecessor to that genre, this concert overture inspired by a work of literature.
I see.
Yeah.
Huh. That's so neat. So, yeah, let's take a listen.
What does this make you think of?
Well, it makes me think, wow, he was 17 when he wrote this? That is... I mean, just the opening is so...
Setting the tone of that magical forest.
Uh-huh.
And we've got our fairies scampering around.
It reminds me of, oh my goodness, the Nutcracker Suite a little bit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the...
Which would be written later.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, who knows, Tchaikovsky had heard this and it was in his subconscious. So after those, the fairy dancing, now we have this very regal fanfare, which I think of as the human world. So just as Shakespeare's play moves between the fairy world and the human world, Mendelssohn's music, you could interpret it as doing the same.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might think of it as hunting calls going on here in the foresty theme, or this sort of majestic sound of, you know, there's a wedding that's going to be happening soon.
This is what I find so interesting about classical music as I've listened to more of it during this show. When Amy and I were talking about tome poems in our episode, I was just sort of fascinated by the way that Smetana was able to capture the sound of water flowing. And now, you know, I'm listening to Mendelssohn wordlessly, you know, create this fairy scene and then move between that and this very sort of regal, you know, scene like you're talking about. I mean, maybe that is what you are supposed to appreciate about classical music, but this is totally new to me, you know, just sort of seeing that aspect in the music.
I think when you can feel a story being told, I mean, although that is certainly not the only way to appreciate classical music, but storytelling is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And listen to this part. So we have the braying donkey. That's bottom.
Oh.
Going hee-haw, hee-haw.
Uh-huh. I like that part. Oh, yeah. And this is more regal Theseus action happening.
I mean, what I love about this music, and in particular the overture, was, or I should say is, that you can hear all the characters and just feel the story unfold. Mm-hmm. So we're back to sort of more fairies plotting.
Yeah. So this overture
of the humans.
It's kind of, it really is kind of giving a musical Cliff Notes version.
Yeah,
of
kind of
of the play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And foreshadowing.
Yeah, okay.
Like you won't hear the wedding march theme in the overture. And he might not have conceived it at this point because he was only 17 and not writing for a stage production. But you won't hear the wedding theme, but you'll hear... So maybe he doesn't want to give that part away, you know, it being an overture. But I think of this, what's happening right now, I think of it as foreshadowing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, there's a little bit of, there's still sort of this like fairy, light fairy playfulness going on, but we just heard some of these powerful dramatic horn calls, like as if, something might be brewing.
Yeah. Something dark and mysterious.
Pizzicato? Pluck, pluck, pluck.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Puck making a mess of things? I'm gonna...
I like that.
Yeah. He's sneaking around.
Tiptoeing.
You know? Yeah.
I first heard this piece when I was in eighth grade, when I was reading the play for the first time, and totally brought the story to life.
That's so cool.
I was a nerd.
No.
Reading Shakespeare in my spare time and listening to Mendelssohn.
What do you
on
mean?
On vinyl.
Were a nerd.
Touché.
It's okay, I was too. This is the first time I've really listened to Mendelssohn. I mean, I've heard Mendelssohn, but I haven't really ever listened.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like it. It's really... it kind of reminded me, actually, of Smetana. The sort of... there being all of these different moving parts, and it's so intricate. It's such intricate sort of... It sounds sort of fragile, delicate, you know.
And very expressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Mendelssohn was a prodigy, much like Mozart. And sometimes people forget or might not even know that about him. I mean, he was like a child prodigy, and he wrote a bunch of music as a teenager. I mean, such as this.
Mm.
And he was from a privileged family.
Mm.
He He spoke multiple languages. He was a watercolorist.
Also a nerd, you guys.
And he had an older sister, Fanny, who was also, I believe all his siblings were musical. His older sister, Fanny, her music is still played today. She was a pianist and composer. And then he had a brother named Paul, who was a cellist. Paul Mendelssohn. Doesn't get enough credit.
That's what I always say.
So here's Bottom again, braying.
Definitely some cartoon action going on.
Yeah,
in this music.
A little Looney Tunes vibe. And what's also amazing about this overture is that he not only did he write it young, but later, 16 years later, when he wrote the incidental music officially, he, you know, tacked on the overture, but then the rest of the incidental music is so seamless from the overture. Like, he created the same spirit and the same sort of style, and you'll even hear him reuse some of the same themes, like the braying of the donkey.
Yeah.
So, I mean, can you imagine returning to something you started 16 years ago and make it seamless?
No. I mean, and especially, you know, as having written it as a teenager. I mean, I guess if you wrote something as an adult and then maybe went back to it in your later life, I could see that. But as a teenager, you know, your brain isn't formed yet. and you're going back to something from a, like, almost an entirely different person by the time you're in your 30s. So yeah, that's impressive.
Now I think we're heading into my favorite part. A lot of fairy action.
A lot of fairy action
in this overture and in the play, of course.
Yeah. So we're still entering.
Here we go.
Your favorite part. Okay.
Ah, the strings. So this is, you know, the lovers falling asleep.
Okay.
In the forest.
Yeah.
Maybe that final time when things have finally sorted themselves out.
Right.
It's like a little lullaby section. And, you know, you think of, you know, this is where you think of Puck saying, if we shadows have offended, think but this and all is mended, you know, that you have but slumbered here while these visions appeared. That's what this part is.
That's great.
It's just a dream. It was all a dream.
All a dream. Wow. Okay, so the overture, that's our preview, our you know, sort of summary of the play, and foreshadowing. And then where do we go from there?
Well, we can go right into the next movement, which is the scherzo.
Okay, now what is a scherzo?
Excellent question. I came prepared.
Glad you asked.
Glad you asked, Dacia Clay. So scherzo, technically, literally in Italian, it means joke. A scherzo is usually a movement within a larger work, but it could be a standalone piece. That is usually, and it doesn't, it's not always jokey or necessarily lighthearted in spirit, though it can be and often is, but it is a sort of quick, playful piece.
Okay.
And Mendelssohn's scherzo, what we're listening to right now, has become very famous and almost like a standard for scherzos. I mean, he didn't invent the scherzo by any means. It had been around, but the sort of light, sort of fairy dancing that he creates in this scherzo, gossamer, flitting about, that was unique, and is still beloved today. And this movement is still even arranged and performed on its own.
Oh, really? So scherzo basically means schizo. Like, it's jumping all over the place. It's crazy.
So this scherzo movement, it's one of the most famous sections of the incidental music.
Really?
And, I mean, I think it's illustrating more of the fairy world.
Mm-hmm.
The plotting, the scheming.
Right.
And the lightness.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have wings?
I don't know.
In this play, I can't remember, but did they fly?
I mean, I assume that's what distinguishes a fairy from a human, but...
But this sort of floaty, you know, just otherworldliness, but also great mischief.
Yeah. Once Mendelssohn kind of set the gold standard for scherzos. What was anything born out of that?
He went on to write. I mean, you can find examples of similar scherzos in his other pieces, where he just was so good at creating this kind of mood and atmosphere.
Yeah,
and people will even refer to it as, you know, a Mendelssohnian scherzo.
It's
like become a noun and an adjective on its own.
I want to become an adjective.
What would your adjective be?
I don't know.
Dacian?
Yeah, it's very... It's, the pace of this never stops.
Mm-hmm.
It just starts right out of the gate and it keeps going.
I have even heard an arrangement of this movement, the scherzo, on Russian folk instruments, like the balalaika, the domra. And it's still good. Which just shows how, you know, a great melody can really translate.
I was just thinking that it would be really cool for like a speed metal band to perform that, turn it into like a 2-minute piece. Okay, so this is Nocturne, which I'm assuming has something to do with nighttime, because I'm so smart.
A midsummer's night.
Oh, whoa. Synapses connecting.
So what does this make you?
Well, this is clearly when they're sleeping, and...
Yeah, love is in the air.
Yeah. Love is in the air.
love potions are in the air.
Uh-huh. I'm thinking this is the part where everybody is innocently sleeping and Puck is going around and, you know, drugging them all.
All in a day's work.
All in a day's
work.
For
a fairy.
Yeah. So, a nocturne, and you said, you know, clearly, Midsummer Night's Dream, there's the connection between night,
and the story.
And the, mm-hmm. But, is a nocturne a kind of music as well? Is this strictly?
No, it is also a genre.
Oh, okay.
You'll find lots of examples of nocturnes by many composers. Mm-hmm. Chopin wrote many nocturnes for solo piano, mm-hmm. and for example.
Mm-hmm. And a nocturne clearly is sort of the antithesis of a scherzo. It's very sleepy. A lot of French horn going on up in there.
Night music.
Night music. I like that.
So you can imagine like the warm breezes, the moonlight, mm-hmm. the forest as the lovers are falling asleep. Mm-hmm. They're not going to know what hit them. And I just love how there is such fantasy in this play. There's mistaken identity mm-hmm. in all these great Shakespearean hallmarks. There's mistaken identity. They're feisty, mm-hmm. disobedient women.
Yeah, that's right, because Hermia, the reason that they're in the forest, and they're like, this is not taking place at the castle or wherever they live, in the human world, is because, like, her father has said, you know, you're going to marry Demetrius, or you're going to be, you know, punished to the full extent of law, which I'm assuming, like, at that time, you know, you could actually be imprisoned or something by for not doing what your dad said to do. Mm-hmm. And so she says, yeah, whatever. And she goes off and she finds the man that she loves and she's like, come on, let's go get married in the forest instead. She's just like completely unafraid and mm-hmm. she gets her best friend. You guys may be familiar with this one.
So we've skipped some sections, but, you know, hit on some major plot points, uh-huh. and here's our happy ending.
It's so hard.
It's a comedy. Everybody gets married.
Right? And to the proper people, despite Puck's screw-ups. You know, it's really hard to hear this music as anything other than wedding music. You know, to hear it as, I mean, clearly this was the first time that people were hearing this was as incidental music for this play. But it's so, I mean, it is now everyone's wedding music. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to hear it as part of a piece or part of this grouping of music.
And I have a fun fact for you.
Ooh, fun fact.
If you don't already know this. Yeah. So this piece was written in 1842, mm-hmm. as we said earlier, and it was in 1858 that it was used at a real royal wedding for the first time. Huh. And it appeared at the wedding of Princess Victoria Adelaide Mary Louise.
Wow.
She was the oldest child of Queen Victoria, mm-hmm. and she was getting married to Frederick William IV of Prussia, mm-hmm. again, on January 25th, 1858. And she was the one, trendsetter, who started it all. She used this as her recessional music,
huh.
and it has since caught on.
That's so cool. What on earth did people play at weddings before this song came about?
Oh. Well, I mean, I guess there are a number of examples of how classical music is so embedded into our popular culture. Mm-hmm. And this is one of them, how it's just endured mm-hmm. for so long.
It's just synonymous with weddings. I mean, this music, you only have to hear, it's kind of like the whole leitmotif thing where you just need to hear a few notes and you're like, oh, it's wedding. Somebody's getting married. Yeah. Okay, so you said this. Now, what other pieces of classical music are embedded in this? You know, just culturally.
If you think of... Well, I think of when I think of pop culture, I think of commercials uh-huh. and all the classical music you hear in commercials. Mm-hmm. For example, like Pachelbel's Canon.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
do you remember
yeah.
when it was used in those GE commercials in the 80s? I do.
I don't.
But you know, Pachelbel's Canon is also used at weddings.
Oh yeah, that's true.
All the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good example.
Rodeo by Aaron Copland, there's a really famous dance called Hoedown, mm-hmm. and that was used by the Beef Council of America to sell beef.
Really?
And so whenever I hear that tune, it's like, beef, what's for dinner? That was the commercial while Copland was playing.
Yeah. So, listeners, if you guys can think of any other pieces of classical music that are very firmly embedded in our collective cultural consciousness, send me an email at dclay@classical917.org. I'd be interested to know what you guys think. So, that's the end of the play. Everybody's married. Curtain goes down. Did Shakespeare have curtains? I don't know.
People threw flowers on the stage. I don't know. Something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, triple wedding. So everybody gets the right girl and the right guy. Mm-hmm. I think the thing with the fairy king and queen, Titania and Oberon, I think that gets resolved as well. Mm-hmm. I think she does give up the changeling boy. They take the spell off of her, or they reverse the spell. She's no longer in love with Bottom as a donkey. Back with Oberon. and I love this monologue that we end with Puck, the one who, the fairy who sort of has created a lot of this, was responsible for a lot of this mischief because he's put the spells on the wrong people. Mm-hmm. And he kind of faces the audience and says, you know, no offense. This is all for fun. Pretend it was a dream.
Yeah.
Pretend we're still friends, right?
Goodbye.
Just such a charming, charming play, in my opinion. And
yeah.
Equally so, the music, which just, I think, tells the story so well. Like, I can't think of the two things separate from each other.
Mm-hmm. I could really hear it when you were explaining it to me. It really reminded me, in fact, a lot of my Star Wars lesson. So I can never hear the music to Star Wars in the same way again, because now I'm hearing all of these leitmotifs about, you know, that signify the different characters. Themes. And this was very much like that. A part of the play is represented in the music. I totally did not hear that when I was listening to it on my own. That's fascinating. So cool.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Catherine. This was really cool. So I learned all about what incidental music was, what a scherzo is, what
check,
an overture
check,
is.
Check.
Yeah. I got a lot out of this lesson.
Great.
I'm going to go out and try to find more examples of scherzos because I think those are pretty cool. And I really would love to hear a speed metal version of this one.
Yeah. Well, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on Classical Classroom.
You're welcome. Anytime, if you want to come back, please do. Everybody, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.